It was a slightly overcast day as the voices of the choir from the St. Paul United Methodist Church wafted out across the audience of around 100 or so for the new exhibit on slavery. They stood just yards from the house on the Ratcliffe Plantation, whose 18 slaves are now listed on the walls of a room on the second floor. The exhibit also includes artifacts as part of the history of Worcester County in Maryland. Clara Small is Professor Emeritus at Salisbury University.
This local historic exhibit of the enslaved at Ratcliffe House, which spans from the colonial period to 1870, is presented at a very appropriate time in our history.
It has been 400 years since the first Africans in bondage arrived ashore in Virginia. Initially, the labor force was made up of both white indentured servants and slaves. The farms were small, and workers both indentured and enslaved worked side by side. But then came a revolution that would change the face of the Eastern Shore, the rise of tobacco. Jacqueline Hedberg is author of Plantations, Slavery and Freedom on the Eastern Shore.
When the tobacco became essential, the central part of the economy, and you need lots of labor and you need it year-round, then you've got a different situation altogether. The number of slaves that were bought in the Chesapeake at the end of the 17th century, the beginning of the 18th century, skyrocketed. And when that happened, you ended up with a society that was totally dependent upon slave labor.
Indeed, the large plantation owners controlled the local governments and legislatures, the courts where they were judges, and even the churches where they were deacons. And the laws became harsher with each passing year.
One of the first things that they did is that the second time somebody ran away, they branded him with an R on his forehead. Later, they cut off ears. I mean, really harsh punishments. And the whip was common practice. And there were owners who got reputations for breaking slaves, or overseers who had that reputation. And they made a habit of whipping either one slave or more on a regular basis on the plantation.
But they were also the economic engines of plantation life. Linda Ayers, member of the Ratcliffe Board of Directors and project manager for the exhibit at Ratcliffe.
They did everything here. They ran the household, cooked the meals, did the laundry, emptied the chamber pots. They worked in the fields. They worked on the water. They grew the crops. They tended the livestock. And they helped to create and maintain the wealth of this plantation.
In essence, author Hedberg says, the Eastern Shore had moved from a society with slaves to a slave society that was predominantly dependent on slavery for its many needs. When the region approached the American Revolution, that dependency had already begun to wane. Tobacco ate up the nutrients in the soil, leaving it unsuitable after around 3 years. Eventually, the cultivation of grains as well as livestock replaced tobacco. Hedberg notes that this caused many slave owners to hire them out.
So when that happens, you don't need slave labor constantly all year round. You only need them for the planting and you need them for the harvesting. So you have a lot of time in the middle when they're free, and they began hiring out practices. They would hire their slaves, you know, to other people. Slaves began to work in shipbuilding. They began to work in timbering industries.
This decline led to an increase in another feature of bondage, the slave trade. Patty Cannon, who lived along the Delaware-Maryland border, is probably the most infamous figure. With her family, she snatched up enslaved and free blacks, and often kept them chained in leg irons until there were enough to send off to as far away as Georgia. But the biggest slave traders of their time were located off Delmarva, with names such as Woolfolk and Franklin and Armfield. Jacqueline Hedberg.
I think there was a period of time when more than half the percentage of the slaves that were being sent south out of the Port of Baltimore were ones that were going because Woolfolk was selling them south. And then there was Franklin and Armfield in Alexandria. He had most of the people that they were taking south walked, which is even a sadder story, walking in coffles that were in chains all the way from Alexandria across Virginia, across Tennessee, across Mississippi to Natchez.
Hedberg also notes at this time, many owners were freeing their slaves, building up what had already become a rising free black population. But she says despite their liberation, known as manumission, there were still many restrictions.
You know, here they are, free people, that they had to go to the magistrate every year, pay a fee, register. You had to have a description of them, how they had been freed, whether they had any marks. Then they had to have licenses. They had to have a license to sell corn. They had to have a license to have a dog. They had to have a license to sell tobacco. Then they couldn't move around freely. Eventually, there were rules that you couldn't manumit anybody. And the very worst one at the end said if you were older than 18, you could put yourself back into slavery.
Despite those restrictions, the most famous abolitionists were former slaves who had escaped from bondage, often with the help of those same free blacks. We'll take a look at that part of the story in our next segment. This is Don Rush for Delmarva Public Radio.